A JSO drug sting lands a family with police ties in hot water. Duval County Schools puts male mentors in the classroom. And Shad Khan unveils more big plans for the downtown sports complex. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9, and now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Never miss a show. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. Then later, weird Florida news from all around the state. We'll tell you about the local nonprofit Aging True, plus a look ahead to this year's Jackstoberfest. That's right, it's just around the corner. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly roundtable here today. Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union, good to see you.
Good morning.
Claire Goforth is here, writer at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
Hey, Claire. And our own WJCT analyst, John Burr, joining us.
Good morning.
Guys, so good to have you on the show. Thanks for being here. And plenty of news to talk about this Friday. From Shad Khan's latest moves to education news from around the state to some unrest over Mayor Curry tossing Alvin Brown appointees off local boards. All of that and more going on. But first this morning, the TU reports that JSO officer Betty Pearson is out on bail today after she is charged with trying to help her son evade capture by fellow cops. This police probe was chasing a cocaine ring. And police had a warrant out for both the Pearson father and the son in this family. This is a very intriguing and complicated story. We'll take your calls on it as we kick off the roundtable at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Dan Scanlon, let's begin with you. JSO had been secretly recording and following a father and son and an uncle during a probe into two major local cocaine rings. And it turns out that this family had ties to the police department.
Well, our own Jim Schottler was on the tail of this one for many weeks, and we've had a number of stories about the cocaine conspiracy out there. And then yesterday we had a call that the undersheriff was going to hold a press conference, and we find out that one of their own was arrested. My question when I attended that press conference to him was, is this the only one? Is this the only officer on board who's been helping a suspect try to evade capture? And he looked at me and said, yes, that we know of. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, later, the sheriff and Angela Corey and others had a mass press conference to talk about the scope of this arrest, with a dozen people either arrested or being sought, million plus in cocaine coming from Texas to Florida and being distributed in the northwest sector of Jacksonville. And they say they're going to put their foot down and try to stop it and make it a tough city. But it all started with a 15-year veteran police officer, 7 years corrections, 8 years on the street, getting put on desk duty last Thursday, gun removed, investigation wrapped up, and then arrested on Wednesday night, where the undersheriff said she was very calm when she was arrested.
It's 549-2937 to join the show. 11 arrests made in this sting, Claire and John, including that of three reported drug kingpins. The cocaine shipped from two separate sources in Houston, coming into the country, they say, from Mexico. Claire Goforth.
And, you know, I would wonder whether or not, and correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't JSO say they're still investigating whether or not Officer Pearson was, in fact, involved in the trafficking ring?
Yeah, the question is, did she have any physical contact? She apparently was on the phone with her son trying to help him avoid things, and then also called the son's girlfriend to, I guess, assist in her picking him up to help avoid police. So that is still yet to be discussed. You're right.
And the son actually lived with her. Is that correct?
Well, for a brief period of time, both son and mother were in the same Duval County jail, but she bonded out yesterday.
And you know, John Burr, Sheriff Williams telling Jim Schottler of the Times Union, who broke this story, by the way, that we're talking about hundreds of pounds of coke coming into the city. It's going all over the city. People all over the city are using the coke, but they're mainly going to the northwest side to buy the coke. That is a problem police have been dealing with for many, many years.
Oh, certainly. And, you know, it's nice to see that the Sheriff's Department is doing investigations like this. I can't remember the last time they broke up a big drug ring like this. You know, and what's good about it, besides the obvious of getting, you know, some cocaine and some bad people off the street, is, you know, much of the violence in Jacksonville is fueled by the by the drug trade, the murders and the assaults. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you know, Jacksonville has a really bad record in terms of murders.
Give us a call at 549-2937 to discuss the top stories of the week. It's got to be doubly frustrating for the new sheriff to see that, on the one hand, they've scored a victory with this bust, Dan. On the other hand, one of their own officers had a tie to this.
Well, their integrity unit has been working on this for quite a while, obviously, and so has Jim Schottler. I mean, I sit near him, and he has been dogging this for a while, and there's no greater bulldog in our newsroom than Jim Schottler when it comes to digging up this stuff. The question is, you're right, how much deeper might this go? Are there other officers or other staff members who, because they have access to the police computers, are passing information? We've had one or two incidents of this in the past year that I remember covering. It's not obviously widespread, but when the undersheriff looks at me and says, not that we know of, I hope that sends a scare out to others, other officers to stop doing this.
Yes, and I get the sense that JSO is sort of circling the wagons for Officer Pearson by not releasing some of her records. I mean, it may be Friday, but the news is still going on. And, I mean, they are not releasing the picture of her son. I feel like they're using provision that keeps them from publishing the pictures as a, not to protect her so much, but probably just to try to minimize the impact of this story.
So, that's not a courtesy that will be extended to any other suspect, is what you're saying.
That's correct.
No, SOP, if you're a sheriff's office employee, you are not in the system, you are not listed in the computer, and inmates, your photo is not released as others are, and ostensibly it is to protect that officer from, mm-hmm. from repercussions, yet one of the TV stations did dig up a photo of both of them yesterday.
Well, I understand that, but, it's hard. Just knowing what we know, it's hard to think that she didn't know about her son's involvement. I mean, her son and her husband live in the same house. They're cutting cocaine on the kitchen table.
Husband, according to
whatever. I mean, it's a stretch to think that she was totally blind to what was going on. In fact, her action in warning her son proves that she wasn't.
The Times Union's Schottler reporting that Pearson is accused of alerting her son that police were coming after him. She would have known this since she works at JSO. Talking with his girlfriend about helping him escape, mm-hmm. those alerts occurred during telephone conversations, according to Undersheriff Pat Ivey. He told the media about this Thursday. Let's go to your calls right now, 549-2937. Dave along I-95. Hi, Dave. Happy Friday. Go ahead.
Happy Friday to you, too. I was just listening to this drug bust. I heard about it yesterday. And I can't help but wonder, does anyone in their wildest fantasies think that this drug bust is going to have any appreciable impact on the availability of cocaine to people that want it? And, why do we continue to invest more time, money, and livelihood in this failed war on drugs? And why do we not treat it as a health issue as opposed to a legal issue? And I'll take my response up here. Thank you.
Dave, thanks for the call. Claire.
He makes an excellent point. The drug war is failing. I mean, this eastbound and down operation, as soon as the dust settles from that, another gang is going to take its place. Cocaine is still going to remain available in Jacksonville, primarily probably in the Northwest quadrant. And I mean, it really raises questions about our priorities as a society, whether or not we continue to dump millions of dollars and incarcerate thousands and millions of people fighting a war that we're never going to win.
And let's not forget, too, that the meth problem, we've had a drastic increase in meth labs, mm-hmm. In buckets, in backs of trucks, in homes with kids. And not just in Duval County, Putnam, Clay, St. John's, they're popping up all over the place and causing fires when they go wrong.
Well, then the question would be, if you treat it as a public health issue, that's a major realignment. How do you go about that? Let's have that conversation.
Well, if you want to talk about public health, let's talk about selling cocaine in liquor stores or whatever, because that's the natural progression we're talking about if we're talking about legalizing cocaine.
And I don't think anyone's saying that. I think what the caller is saying is that people would be less likely to be attracted to using cocaine if other areas, if other public health issues were addressed.
That is a point. But I wonder whether or not we could possibly envision a system in which we legalized all drugs, and in order to purchase them, you had to register with your identification card, make it affordable, and take the supply out of the hands of criminals and put it with the government. We would make so much money from a system like that. I think that it would be extremely controversial and very difficult to push that through in our political landscape. But it may be a way to just address the reality that people are going to do drugs, they're going to buy drugs, they're going to become addicted to them. And rather than incarcerating them and letting criminals profit off it, maybe we should rethink our entire system of handling drugs.
Chuck at the beaches. Go ahead, Chuck.
Hi, guys. I'm going to follow up on your last caller, and I want to suggest to you and your listeners and your guests to go to TED Talks and pull up the TED Talks on the gentleman who talks about the legalization of drugs in Portugal. And if we could study what they've done in Portugal and what they did in Portugal was they made all these drugs that were having problems with legal, and they took in aspects, and then they took the money that they were using to put people in prison with, and they put it into mental health and ways to deal with the reason that people self-medicate themselves, and they cut the rate of drug abuse by 50%.
Right, right. Yes. Yeah, that's what I was getting at, Chuck, because in so many ways, people are self-medicating when they abuse drugs. Yeah.
Yes, so please, and I would encourage you specifically to look at that. It's on TED Talks, and it's about the thing in Portugal, and your guests, and see, this happened in Portugal. This really happened. They cut their drug abuse by 50%.
Thank you, Chuck. Thanks for that, and it's an important story, one that I know the Times Union will continue to follow, but we do need to continue and touch on a few other stories that made news this week here on our Friday Media Roundtable. The number to join the show, 549-2937. Well, Mayor Lenny Curry's administration is just about done with its budget work, but they did take some flack recently after tossing three high-profile people off local independent authority boards. These are supposed to be insulated from partisan politics. All Alvin Brown appointees, Ernest Isaac on the Jacksonville Aviation Authority Board, Nancy Soderberg on the Port Board, and one other. Dan Scanlon, the Curry administration is saying, look, elections have consequences. We can appoint and unappoint who we like.
But as Ron Littlepage's editorial this week pointed out, these are independent boards, and if they're doing their job, then they shouldn't be affected by politics, and especially someone as talented as Ambassador Soderberg, to take her off a board where she has contacts, where she has the basis, the knowledge. I've interviewed her numerous times, and ask her a question, she has an answer. So it did surprise me, and I, as Ron also pointed out in his editorial, this seems to be the policy of the former state Republican chairman, continued as mayor, that you make a decision based on the Republican principles and not as a mayor who's supposed to be inclusive to all.
Right. There seems to have been some pushback on City Hall from some Republicans as well, John, telling the new mayor, look, this isn't how business has been done in the past. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think what's upsetting people most is that it was just a unilateral action. You didn't give the individuals any, you know, credence as to whether they're doing a good job or a bad job. They just politically weren't, you know, palatable to the Curry administration, especially with Nancy Soderberg and her point of chair. I think, you know, everybody thought she was like perfectly placed in that job. She knows international trade backwards and forwards, and was a real asset to the port. So, you know, it is true that the mayor has the authority to do what he wants with these mayoral appointments. Maybe if he had been a little bit more, you know, case by case in his choice, you know, it would have gone down a little better.
Claire.
You know, and what kind of message does it send where you're getting rid of some of the most talented people that are working in city government because they express a political opinion that differs from yours throughout the campaign and in beginning days of his mayoral as being mayor, he went on about one city, one Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. Is this one city, one Jacksonville, where we fire people that are doing an excellent job on independent authorities? I know there are 299 staffers right now who had to submit their letters of resignation, as is protocol, who are extremely nervous that they're all going to face retribution for any statements they made during the campaign.
Well, but you know, to be fair to the new administration, people do serve at the pleasure of the mayor and anyone who's an employee of the city, of course they might lose their job. I think that this flap stems from the unique nature of these independent authorities. Is that right, Dan?
I would think so. But again, they've been doing their job, and in most cases, they do their job unnoticed by the general public. I mean, the Port Authority, obviously, has been popping up in the news of late, but the other boards are almost unknown to us. And if they do their job, then there should be no repercussions. But then again.
And the other person who was asked to resign, Melody Bishop, the wife of the other candidate for mayor, Bill Bishop, forgot to mention that. But we're getting a lot of calls, meanwhile, about the other big story of the week, the drug issue. 549-2937, Mitchell in Palatka. Hi, Mitchell. Go ahead.
Yes, this is a comment on the drug problem. I've never smoked the marijuana and have no interest in any of these things, but I think the way to empty the jails and to get a real control on the problem is to make it legal to grow and sell any kind of poisonous plant whatsoever, like tomatoes and cocaine, but it would continue to be just as criminal if you concentrated the poisons in the plants and tried to sell the poisons. So people could grow their own plants, they could smoke whatever they felt like smoking, they could sell the plants, the seeds, anything, and the whole market for drugs would collapse because there would be so much marijuana that the value of marijuana and all of these things would just fall to zero.
Mitchell in Palatka, thanks for the call.
Well, most interesting, I just decided to take a look at the jail intake log for yesterday, and just off the top, possession of marijuana, purchase heroin, possession of marijuana, and this is going in alphabetical order. It just continues. Possession of marijuana. There's child abuse. There's other things here. Drug paraphernalia, distribution, possession of cocaine. Enough said. A lot of the people in the jail are there because of drug
issues. That's right.
I think you make a great point. I think all these issues are going to be decided drug by drug. And the marijuana issue very clearly is moving toward a legalization posture.
Yeah.
Here and around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Cocaine is a whole nother thing. And, a lot of people, from a law enforcement perspective, the problem is a lot of these people who are dealing these drugs and distributing these drugs are also committing murders and assaults and, other heinous crimes. So you can't you can't really just say, these folks are just dealing drugs. There's more to it.
The pro-legalization camp would argue that if you legalize and tax these substances, that takes murder and mayhem out of the equation. Look at the Prohibition era. A lot of lives were lost when alcohol was illegal. The anti-legalization side will argue that you can't legalize hard drugs simply because they're too damaging to the body and brain. Claire?
Well, they do have a point. They are damaging to the body and brain, but people are going to continue to use them, as I said. And another issue that we should discuss is when drugs are not available, people start turning towards legal ways to get high, like bath salts or huffing very dangerous substances, and nobody argues that that's a good idea. And the drug trade not being regulated, the substances themselves, a lot of times these are contaminated. People have been hurt very seriously for just minor use because there are substances cut into cocaine and other drugs that are very damaging to the body.
Lots of calls coming into our Friday Media Roundtable. Larry is in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Larry. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Talking about the mayor, you know, the mayor should pay attention to another great Republican president and read The Team of Rivals. That's all I've got to comment on.
Larry, thanks for the call.
That's the book about Abraham Lincoln
yeah,
and his
sure.
cabinet of rivals and the good that came out of that.
Yeah, well, the whole and that was written by Doris Kearns Goodwin, of course. The whole idea that Lincoln assembled a cabinet of people that opposed him because he felt that would make a stronger cabinet. People from both parties, people that opposed his campaign. I think that's what the caller was
getting
at.
So the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Okay.
Well, no. The idea is it brings up a lot of different viewpoints for mm-hmm. discussion. It's not just a bunch of yes men saying, yeah, that's a great idea.
Let's go to Jared in Springfield. Jared, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to know what our viewers and people think about how much money that our government and our system makes off of arresting all these people for these minor infractions on drugs. And I'll take your answer out the air. Thank you.
Jared, thank you for that. Dan, you were just talking about that a minute ago when you looked through the arrest log.
I have to wonder, with our jail overcrowded, if there's any money to be made and if any of these people can pay the fines that if you look on the clerk of court's website and you see the multitude of fines when they're sentenced, if any money is being made. I dare say the jail is, or any prison system, is working on a deficit or break even at best.
Well,
so.
I think what the argument is that if, you know, the police say 75% of the crime is related to drugs in any city in the United States, including Jacksonville. If you somehow reduce that to, you know, 20%, you wouldn't need so many cops. You wouldn't mm-hmm. need so many court officials. You wouldn't need so many prosecutors because the crime rate would go zzz.
But the case
That's
in point
the argument.
Is the gentleman yesterday who tackled the would-be robber at the Westside Walgreens. The record on the guy that he tackled was 18 arrests. He just got out of jail on Tuesday. And in the arrest report, he said he'd been smoking crack for 3 to 5 days and was desperate.
Let's go to a few more calls. People really want to talk about this topic, by the way. Chris in St. Augustine. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I work both in the addiction and recovery industry as a consultant, as well as the legal cannabis industry throughout the United States. So I have a little bit of interest in both sides. And I think one of the things that got left out in this discussion is, in my opinion, one of the largest drug dealers in our country is the pharmaceutical industry. And they create, we have an OxyContin out there right now that's been approved by the FDA for children of 11 and older. I mean, that's synthetic heroin that you're giving to a child. And it's been approved by the FDA. Our heroin overdose rate is blowing up all over the country, and that's because people can't get the pills that they've been on, such as OxyContin, Percocet, Vicodin, things of that nature. So it's you're trying to turn an aircraft carrier around that's split into so many pieces. You've got Sheldon Adelson, who's the largest owner of privatized jails in the country, fighting against United for Care, because if we don't get people arrested and into the system at an early age for petty drug crimes, then they're not going to end up in jail for 10 and 15 years and supporting lining his pockets. So you've got a whole lot of interests here that go well beyond the illicit drugs that come in from Mexico. With that, I'll get off the air.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you, Chris. Rick at the beaches. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi. I just want to make a point. Somebody would really look at the people who have been arrested, especially those who have been arrested and said they're for trafficking. But they would look and see the trafficking is based upon the amount of drugs. Not that they were out selling it to a bunch of people, but a lot of times if they've got a bad prescription and it's the number of pills that they're being charged with. Most of these people have been hooked on, they've got involved, they got injured, got with a doctor, now they're hooked on the pill. They're being charged with a very serious felony by the amount of pills. They haven't sold it, they're using it themselves, but for their life is ruined because first of all, they're not getting any treatment. Second of all, the state doesn't care, and it makes an easy charge for them to reduce. Either you take 3 years or 6 years. Take a choice. Hmm.
Thank you so much, Rick. Man, we've got so many more callers that want to talk about this issue, but we do need to touch on a few other stories that made news this week. Let's talk for a minute about the organizers of the One Spark Festival, the big crowdfunding event announced this week. They're shrinking their footprint and how many days the festival will run in downtown Jacksonville. Chairman Peter Rummel says participants can expect an improved experience in 2016. Dan.
Well, we, at this very table, the week before or the week of One Spark, talked about how big it had become, and I even did a story on this, and I will tell you the brief stroll that my wife and I took on Saturday night of it, it was massive. Rummel's own comment is that 5 days, quote-unquote, beats the crap out of the people involved is probably very telling. It also shows that they're overextended this year, possibly, and the money isn't coming in. There's still bills to be paid. Cutting the staff, bringing it back down. The only concern I've got is there were some great ideas there, and will we lose some great innovators because you're drastically cutting the size, or will we find the best of the best and come out a winner again?
Yeah, maybe the best of the best will be coming out. Every year there are interesting entries. Bling Bullets was a favorite for many of us. I think that everybody's breathing a big sigh of relief that One Spark is not actually going away,
We will
have it again next year.
Yeah, we're going to see the festival go from 20 blocks to about 12, fewer participants, 3 days now. So a tighter, more intense, more focused impact.
More focused is really, for me, the critical element, because, you know, when you go to One Spark, it's great to have that activity downtown and all those people. But, you know, it's kind of like a big street fair. It's kind of what gets lost is the entrepreneurial part of it. And I think, because people just start drinking beer and listening to bands. So I would love to see more focus. And I think what all that really points to is that, you know, Elton Rivas has a lot of good talents, and he's, you know, kudos to him for bringing this thing to where it is today. But one of his talents is not managing money, and the money has not been managed well, and they're bringing people in who who do know how to take care of the money.
And the money man behind it, Peter Rummel, it was striking to see. This is a pretty serious, hard-nosed business guy. I think all would agree. Uh-huh. He was actually brought to tears as he was speaking with reporters about how this festival has affected the city of Jacksonville.
The sad part is that that's the only time that anybody usually ever takes the Skyway Express. It's the only time that thousands ever see the downtown. And I had a little concern about the expanded beer garden. Again, as John said, I think we lost the focus on the entrepreneurs, the innovators, because I walk through and I'm not looking at the cool ideas like I was the previous 2 years. I'm looking at the food and the beer choices.
Right. And the other side of that coin is, are 350,000 people going to show up just for an entrepreneurial show? Good question.
But of those 350,000 people, how many of them were actually voting and participating in One Spark, and how many of them were there to drink beer and listen to music, which is fun, but it really wasn't the essence of the festival.
Yeah, we didn't vote this year. We voted the first 2 years. So,
if you're just tuning in, we are discussing the top headlines of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. We want your calls, as always, at 549-2937. Get on the line. Let us know what's on your mind. Lots of education news to talk about. In Duval County, Superintendent Nikolai Vitti rolled out a new program this week that will place role models with young minority men in schools around the district. The 5,000 Role Models campaign, that is happening this year. Now, also this week, Florida education officials say the state's much maligned standardized testing system has been validated. Education Commissioner Pam Stewart called the results welcome news. Of course, it might not really do much to stem the ongoing criticism over Florida's testing system and standards. That will be a controversy that continues to rage in the Sunshine State. Dan Scanlon.
The only thing I can think of is, how can you tell that to the students who had the exam disappear from their screens, lock up and go bye-bye, that this is a legitimate test when they couldn't, you couldn't even sign on in some schools around the state?
Right. Now, Claire, let's talk about this, because they said the state education officials that brought this forth said that they used an outside group to release the findings validating the test.
Yes, I did read that. You know, my concern with this, and I was actually speaking with a sixth grade teacher last night about the testing. She said that her students have done 8 tests so far this year. That's in 2 weeks, and that they're absolutely exhausted by the process. And then she also made the point that teachers are very scared that their pay is going to be cut. I mean, what teacher is going to go and work at a problem high school if they know that next year they're going to lose money?
Now, Superintendent Nicolae Vitti is, speaking of problem schools, he is right in the thick of this on a couple of fronts, John. As I mentioned, he's putting male role models in the schools to mentor young minority male students. At the same time, the Florida Association of School Superintendents has criticized this report. They're really criticizing the test validity, questioning whether it's a valid assessment of the kids and the teachers.
Well, kudos to Vitti for getting more people, these mentors, into the schools. I think that's going to be a critical element. And I think just generally, the more people you get involved in the schools, especially the schools that don't perform as well, it's just positive all the way around. In terms of the testing, you know, the pendulum is swinging very quickly toward anti-testing. You know, Florida was one of the national leaders in implementing tests
under Jeb Bush
was governor. And now we seem to be one of the leaders in trying to pare these things back, because they really have gotten out of control, and they're too much, and they're too much for the teachers, too much for the kids, and they don't really tell you as much as you think they do.
You're teaching to the test.
Let's go to Travis in St. Nicholas. Travis, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I am so glad education came up. I think that wanting kids to be involved in sports and stuff after school is great, but the list of stuff that we had to supply for our kids this year was absolutely insane. When I went to school, you didn't worry about hand sanitizer and all these things, and it was just, the list was insane. And one of the things that's happening at the school where my child goes, Spring Park Elementary, is they had really low reading scores a couple years ago. And I went to the parent-teacher stuff, and I did all that, and only about 60% of the parents even spoke English at Spring Park Elementary. These people are from Bosnia, Serbia, Peru, Nicaragua, Puerto Rico, all over the place, and there's no way for these children to come home and actually learn English, and the whole school is being punished by an extra hour of school every day, and they are not letting our kindergarten children are not allowed to take a nap in a 9-hour school day. It is absolutely insane. So if Mr. Vitti is listening, I'm not sure or if you're aware that this is happening. This is criminal. I studied childhood development, and you can't treat children this way. They need physical education. They need art. They need music. They need science. And this testing, not a single person with any kind of progressive mind in the world think that this type of testing and the way that the Florida educational system is run is worth anything. It's sad, and it needs to change. And the people who are in charge of it, if you're listening, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You should be ashamed. It is 2015, and it's time to have the best students on the planet. And we can do that by letting teachers do what they went to school for, not by playing a leisure.
Travis.
Thank you.
Yep, got it, Travis. There is a lot of emotion around this, and we appreciate that call, Travis. We really do. Everyone who called today. But we are running a little tight on time, so we want to take a quick look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. This scares me. Only in Florida do king cobras escape captivity and slither free in suburbia. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission says the privately owned non-native venomous snake escaped from a cage at its home in Orlando. It's 8 feet long, green and yellow. Owner Mike Kennedy is an exotic animal dealer and star of the Discovery Channel show Airplane Repo. He could face criminal charges for not telling police about the escape, and the snake is near a school. People are very upset, apparently.
A non-venomous cobra?
No, it is venomous. It's non-native.
No. Oh, non-native.
Yeah,
okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Only in Florida do KFC lovers pass out in the drive-thru after going on a compressed air bender. A Miami man is facing charges after authorities say he passed out in his car at the KFC drive-thru in Central Florida in Stuart. They found 32-year-old Scott Shipula asleep in a Chevy Camaro. He had a can of compressed air in his hand and several other empty ones strewn throughout the vehicle.
Compressed air or what else?
Boy, talking about hissy fits in both cases.
And finally, only in Florida, this is a cute one, do school officials turn the tables on their students on Twitter. Down in Palm Beach County, the district was under a flood watch the other day. School officials decided to troll the kids by teasing them with a tweet saying, "Who wants to know if there will be school tomorrow? Answer is coming in minutes." The kids erupted with a barrage of angry tweets, protesting and demanding to know whether school was in or out. Palm Beach County schools kept the suspense going for a while on social media. They finally tweeted out that school would be in session Monday. Predictably, the kids were not happy. We used to hear about the school closings on the radio.
Yes, I know. Yeah. With blizzards. May I add one more quickly, Melissa?
Yes, do
Only
it.
In Florida does a Pembroke Pines Arby's employee tell a uniformed sergeant who is an award-winning swimmer, you can't have a roast beef sandwich.
What?
That was announced yesterday. And Arby's in Pembroke Pines refused to serve a uniformed sergeant.
That is just un-American.
A roast beef sandwich?
Why? Well, I'm used to saying that. I mean,
John Stewart would be thrilled.
John Stewart would love that one. That's right. Well, thanks to our media panel, John Burr, Claire Goforth, and Dan Scanlon. Have a great Labor Day, you guys. And thanks for being
here. You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks, you too.
We're right back.
Join us for the radio variety show that celebrates the culture, art, and history of Northeast Florida.
Wake up in the morning, yeah.
Swamp Radio features musicians, poets, playwrights, and interviews that tell the unique story of our home.
My idea was to take them to the epicenter of Southern cooking, the Waffle House.
What you do best is most everything.
Swamp Radio, Friday evening at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Oscar season seems to start in Colorado, and it's bringing in a lot of money.
6 months, and Starting in Telluride is devoted to Oscar campaign. So that's a multi-million dollar business.
I'm Molly Wood. A look at the business of film festivals next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
I'm John Dankosky. On Signs Friday, we're paying tribute to Oliver Sacks. We'll hear from friends and colleagues and, of course, the man himself.
I think basically I'm a sort of naturalist and an explorer, and I would just want to see more of the human and animal and plant and mineral diversity of the world.
Join us on Signs Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, they are the critical nonprofit that provides home health, mental wellness, nutrition, and caregiver programs all across this area for our aging community. Aging True are the folks who prepare and deliver the Meals on Wheels program for Duval County. And not only do they work with seniors, they also reach out to that so-called sandwich generation. Those are the folks that care for elderly parents and their own kids. And boy, aren't there a lot of those out there. It is a tough job. But it's easy to help Aging True this fall here in our area. You can either buy a pizza or go play some golf. We all love to do both of those things, right? Treya Robinson, Director of Development, joins us now with more. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning.
So nice to talk to you. And let's talk for a little bit about all of this stuff, because first of all, we couldn't get along without Meals on Wheels in this county for senior citizens. That is such an important service.
It is a vital program here in Duval County, and it impacts more people than many of us realize. Seniors and aging is one of those things that we don't think about until it's actually upon us. And for many individuals, especially those that you referenced in that same sandwich generation, this is an important time and this is an important program that helps them be able to continue to provide for their family members and maintain, or their aging family members, while maintaining caring for their younger family members.
That's right. You're looking after the older couple, which helps the sandwich generation, gives them peace of mind. It takes a little bit of the pressure off.
One of our primary goals is not only to be able to be a resource for seniors, but also to be a resource for the caregivers of those seniors as well.
And how do you do that besides Meals on Wheels?
We do it in many ways. We have relief and respite programs where we offer services to family members of seniors by coming in so that they can still go to work or doctor's appointments or any other personal appointments that they need to tend to. So we come in and we offer companion services for seniors. We also do in-home care, personal care, as well as bathing, and a lot of those light cleaning duties that many seniors are not capable of being able to do due to limited physical abilities. So this gives a bit of relief to the family members so that they don't have to come in on Saturday and spend that time doing those chores. They can actually spend that quality time with their senior.
Now, there are two important things to talk about. One involves pizza. Now, who doesn't like pizza, Terea?
I know.
I love pizza. This is a great partnership. Tell us all about Aging True and Papa Murphy's Pizza.
Well, we are so thankful to Papa Murphy's. They opened 4 new locations in Jacksonville last week. And on one of their grand opening days, which was actually last Thursday, 20% of the proceeds from all of their sales actually went to benefit Meals on Wheels. So we're very thankful to Papa Murphy's for their support and donation. And to the community, those individuals who came out and bought pizzas.
Yeah. And now, not only is Papa Murphy's chipping in, it's easy to help Aging True by swinging on by to a big event celebrating the 25th anniversary of Aging True's Golf Classic.
Yes, this is our 25th anniversary. It's a milestone for us. The event is going to be held out at Hidden Hills Golf and Country Club on Friday, October the 2nd. And it is a cocktail event to help us celebrate the 25th anniversary of our Meals on Wheels Golf Classic. The actual Golf Classic is going to be that Tuesday, October the 6th, also out at Hidden Hills.
It's agingtrue.org. Again, that is the Swing On By event celebrating the 25th anniversary of Aging True on the First Coast. This benefits Meals on Wheels, which is such a vital program, but they do so many other things besides Meals on Wheels. So mark your calendar now. Be part of this great event. AgingTrue.org. This is Friday, October 2nd. Still some time to register and be part of it. Terea Robinson with Aging True. Have a great holiday weekend, and thanks so much for spending a little time with us.
Thank you for having us.
We're back in a moment.
Follow what's happening at WJCT even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Relax Radio is the great American songbook, oldies and light jazz.
It's the radio station I was always looking for and never found until now.
Harry Moonbeam's home in a jar.
Relax Radio is the station you can listen to all day on your HD radio. Make a $120 gift to WJCT and you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First is proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, September 12th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Wes Craven, the director best known for his horror films Scream and A Nightmare on Elm Street. He died Sunday. We'll listen back to an interview from 1980, recorded after I saw his film The Last House on the Left, which was so disturbing, I had to call him and ask why he made it. The answer surprised me. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
WJCT is proud to be your number one preset for your evening commute. But if you only turn on 89.9 when you're driving, here's what you're missing.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for
listening. This is The World.
Spend your afternoons with WJCT for unique conversations about the topics of the day. Join us weekdays from 2 to 6 for The Takeaway, The World, and All Things Considered. It's the smart way to spend your afternoon.
Welcome back to the show. Well, finally this hour, we're about to enjoy Labor Day weekend, the official end of summer. But can you believe it's already time to look forward to a signature fall event here on the First Coast, Jackstoberfest. This year, the growing festival is moving from downtown to the St. John's Town Center. Mike White, president of Client Focused Media, and Laura Edgecombe with PRI Productions join us now with a preview of this year's bash. It looks to be bigger and better than ever, guys. Good to see you. Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Mike, let's start with you. You came up with this incredible idea because we really didn't have a big Oktoberfest festival in Jacksonville. It started downtown, was a big hit. Now you're taking it to the, as Alvin Brown might have said when he was mayor, to the next level, right?
We are. The Jackstoberfest, Randy Goodwin, him and I on a chamber leadership trip, came up with an idea to throw something that draws tourists to Jacksonville and focus on downtown. Unfortunately, we're excited to move the town center, but what happened with all the development downtown and the shipyards, we had to end up look for a separate location.
That is unfortunate. Now, does that have to do with Shad Khan's plans for that shipyard's property?
Not so much Shad's plans, but the city's not letting any events on the shipyards right now with the cleanup process. Mm-hmm. We had Mark Lamping at the Jaguars, Tony Slame, and others step up to say, how can we assist? But the event had 50,000 people last year. Our goal, Randy, PRI Productions, and ours is to grow it to about 100,000 to 150,000 people in the upcoming years. And downtown, it would have been more difficult to be able to reach the attendance requirements in a facility.
Got it. So, Laura, that is unfortunate that it is leaving the urban core. However, moving it to the venue of the St. John's Town Center also brings with it some advantages. PRI always does an incredible job with large-scale events. What can we look forward to this year?
Well, just like in past years, you know, we're going to be starting on Friday afternoon around 4 o'clock to get everyone from work to come out and have a happy hour. There's going to be a beer festival that evening for the VIP ticket purchasers. We're going to have local bands and some bands not so local. We are pretty excited about our new lineup. We'll have bands on Friday and on Saturday. On Saturday, we're also going to have contests for both adults and kids. Of course, the Wiener Dog Races are going to be out there just like last year and years past. We'll have broad eating contests, safe slam contests, all the fun beer festival side of it. But for the kids this year, we are going to be upping the games for the Kinderfest area, and we're going to actually have a live pumpkin patch.
Oh,
which
very nice.
It's going to be really cool. We're really looking forward to that. The Town Center has done a lot this year for us, stepped up. They're going to be offering 50% off valet, so you can park for $3 out there and they'll park your car for you. We're going to make it a lot easier for people to be able to come out and enjoy the festivities.
There's going to be a stein holding contest, a broad eating contest, wiener dog races, Mike, a pumpkin bowling contest.
Well, those are just the ones that you've already signed up to participate in. The neat thing about the festival, although Oktoberfest, it is a family fall festival.
Yes.
We had last year thousands of kids on site between 11 and 2 for a lot of the activities. So we want this to be a growing tradition in Jacksonville. It is all, we have no No government funds that come into this, so we're city funds. It is all from our sponsors. We have from Main Street America Group, McCall's Pest Control, U2 Cloud. Companies keep coming to us saying, how can we help grow this festival? So it's really a giant collaboration of great people in the community.
Your goal is to grow this to 150,000 people attending as it keeps getting bigger and bigger. And I think that's very doable.
Absolutely.
Laura, yeah, that's the plan?
Absolutely. That is the plan. You know, one of the nice things about Jacksonville, especially lately, you know, in the past couple of years, everyone is so intent on getting involved. And I think that if we offer an area where the community can all come together, as spread out as we are, if we're able to offer an area where everyone can come together and have a good time, you know, it's only going to get better and better.
Now, this is going to kick off Friday, October 9th, and run through that weekend in October.
Friday and Saturday.
Friday and Saturday at the St. John's Town Center. Will it take over that entire outdoor shopping center? Where will the main footprint be?
So behind the St. John's Town Center, if you go and you park at Dick's, there is a large space, which is actually larger than the shipyards area. So we have more ground space than we did last year. It will be back behind those areas. Not to worry. St. John's Town Center is bringing out the big dogs, and they will have signage everywhere. They're going to have security guards and police officers helping direct traffic. It really will be a very, very easy event.
Are the live shows free?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Free concerts?
There's a general admission ticket, and there's also a VIP ticket. But once you're in, and everything.
Kids under 12 are free. Tickets start at $8 each. But we have many sponsors that you have the ability to go and get some free tickets there. Mm-hmm. VIP is $40, but we want to keep this affordable for the families, as well as very enjoyable. And the great part, again, Town Center is centrally located, which will be so much fun.
It is the third annual Jackstoberfest coming to town once again Friday, October 9th, Friday and Saturday in October. This year, it's moving from downtown to the St. John's Town Center as the event grows and grows. Mike White and Laura Edgecombe, it's going to be really fun and exciting. I can't wait for that crisp fall weather. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, we cannot wait.
I know. I think we all feel that way. But have a great Labor Day, meanwhile, and thank you so much for being with us.
We look forward to seeing you in the Stein hoisting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that's my husband's game. But I'll be eating some pretzels. How about that?
Sounds wonderful. Thank you.
All right. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Emails with feedback about the show, we always appreciate. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And never miss a program. You can subscribe to the daily podcast now at iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, a look at the week's top national news stories. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We will be off for the Labor Day holiday and back Tuesday. Have a safe and happy holiday weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.